Welcome, everyone. You're listening to our deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, October 31st, 2025. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and today we are really going to tear apart the financial and geopolitical landscape revealed in this, well, crucial edition.
And I'm Sam Astor. Alex, you know, if you wanted just a single document that really captures the sheer extremity of the global financial and political moment, I think this paper is it.
Yeah.
We're simultaneously covering nuclear submarines, $60 billion AI contracts, a really high-stakes trade truce, and, believe it or not, the cultural phenomenon of children preferring root vegetables to candy.
It really is an unparalleled mix, isn't it? Our mission today is to give you, the listener, a truly comprehensive, exhaustive, and detailed report of every angle of the sources. Mm-hmm. We're talking geopolitics, intricate corporate deals, trade flows, and, yeah, some of the most unexpected domestic shifts. We're basically providing the shortcut to being completely informed on this pivotal day.
And we really mean comprehensive. We'll try to get into the historical context, the technical details, the competing analyses, and, you know, the long-term implications of every major piece of reporting. Yeah. We want to ensure we extract every nugget of knowledge for you.
Okay, let's start with a quick market recap then, because that already demonstrates some of the conflicting pressures at play here. On the surface, things looked, well, maybe positive. The DJIA closed at 47522.12, up a slight 0.23%. The technology-heavy NASDAQ, that was up 1.6%. And the pan-European STOXX 600 edged up 0.1%. So seemingly a day of global relief and maybe a tech bounce, right?
That's definitely the headline story. But the truth is far more complex. And it probably tells you more about index methodology than overall market health, really.
Okay.
If you look a bit deeper, the S&P 500, which, you know, many consider the best measure of broad U.S. market health, it actually fell 1%. And the Dow dropped 0.2% as well.
Right. That discrepancy is crucial. Why would the NASDAQ cue those strong gains while the S&P 500 dropped like that?
Well, the paper attributes this to post-earnings slumps from, like, massive giants, Meta platforms, and Microsoft.
Ah, okay.
So while the NASDAQ benefited from strength in specific, maybe smaller tech players and, you know, strong outlooks from companies like Amazon, the sheer weight of those poor earnings reports from the absolute largest companies, Meta and Microsoft, that just dragged down the S&P 500 and the Dow.
Right.
Essentially, you could say the foundation of big tech was maybe cracking a bit, even if the general tech mood seemed buoyant. Mm-hmm. It really tells you how concentrated market risk still is.
And the commodities and rates, they seem to reflect that global friction and maybe ongoing inflation anxieties, too. Oil was stable, $60.57, which suggests maybe supply stability for now. But gold, that's the ultimate hedge against uncertainty, right?
Totally.
It broke a major psychological barrier, surging through $4,000 to hit $4,001.30.
Yeah, the gold price is it's basically a flashing red signal. When gold breaks a threshold like $4,000, it tells you that the collective financial community is deeply nervous about either monetary policy, like expecting serious inflation, or, you know, geopolitical stability.
Mm-hmm.
This fear trade, and you couple that with the benchmark 10-year treasury yield holding steady at 4.094%, it indicates that investors are still demanding a pretty significant premium for holding long-term government debt.
Okay, those jitters provide the perfect kind of volatile backdrop for our first segment then, which is centered entirely on global maneuvering and tensions. And let's start with perhaps the most fragile and high-stakes relationship in the world, the U.S. and China.
Right, let's jump into the supposed Trump-Xi trade detente, which the president himself, you know, with his signature flair, rated as a 12 out of 10 truce.
He did.
This is the first face-to-face meeting between President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping in 6 years. 6 years. Held unexpectedly in South Korea. That gap alone tells you how severe the previous tensions really were.
That 12 out of 10 rating, as one analyst put it, it probably highlights the desperation for both sides to get maybe a temporary political win, especially with the U.S. election cycle starting to heat up.
That seems likely, yeah.
So what were the tangible, the immediate concessions from the U.S. side?
Well, the most immediate sort of headline-grabbing move was the agreement to lower a sentinel-related tariff on Chinese goods from 20% down to 10%.
Okay.
Now, this is pretty crucial for optics, right? Linking trade relief directly to the opioid crisis.
And while that's a 10 percentage point reduction, what does it actually mean for, say, the average consumer or importer? Is it a big deal?
Marginal relief, probably.
Yeah.
But it does matter somewhat. This action drops the overall average tariff rate on many Chinese goods from that previously, frankly, crushing 57% down to 47%.
Still high.
Still very high, yeah. The reason it was so high in the first place, remember, was all those accumulated punitive tariffs imposed during the previous administration's trade wars. So the implication is that U.S. consumers might see slightly less inflation on those specific Chinese-made products, making them marginally more competitive against alternatives.
Okay, and the U.S. also provided two other key pauses, right? The first was a one-year pause on export restrictions that were announced back in September.
Correct. That September rule was designed to severely restrict tech flow by applying export limitations to subsidiaries that were at least 50% owned by already blacklisted Chinese entities.
Right.
Pausing this for a year removes an immediate, pretty painful threat to global supply chains involving U.S. technology. And the second pause was on reciprocal port fees on each other's vessels. That smooths out shipping logistics a bit. And it's especially relevant maybe after South Korea agreed to invest, what was it, $150 billion in U.S. shipbuilding. That puts extra pressure on China to kind of play nice on the maritime front.
Okay. Now, in return for these, well, pretty critical concessions, what did the U.S. manage to actually extract from Beijing?
China offered two main things, essentially. First, a promise to crack down on the precursor chemicals used to make fentanyl, addressing the American opioid crisis politically.
Mm-hmm.
And second, a commitment to buy large amounts of U.S. soybeans.
Ah, the soybeans. That pledge is a massive win aimed directly at relieving financial stress in the American rural farming base, isn't it? That's a key political demographic for the president.
Absolutely. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent cited a commitment of 25 million metric tons a year in the coming years.
Yeah.
U.S. farmers, you know, they've been panicking after years of trade wars and Chinese buyers scrambling to places like Brazil. So this is significant relief for them.
But we have to analyze the skepticism surrounding the fentanyl cooperation, right? Analysts note that China has historically treated this kind of cooperation as, well, a political bargaining chip.
Exactly. They offer it when ties are warm, and they immediately pull back when relations sour. There's very little confidence, frankly, that this cooperation will be consistent or thorough this time around either.
And then there's that ongoing friction point. Rare earth minerals. China agreed to ease some export controls on processed rare earths for 1 year, but the crucial mechanism of control, that stays fully operational.
That's the absolute key distinction, yeah. While there's some temporary relief granted, the opaque licensing system China introduced back in April, that remains fully in place.
Okay.
So manufacturers in critical sectors, auto, electronics, and especially defense, they're still frustrated. One U.S. magnet importer cited in the paper noted the supply chain remains seriously delayed because even if licenses are granted, the whole process is arbitrary and unpredictable.
So the truce basically preserves Beijing's ultimate leverage to weaponize this essential resource against the U.S. economy whenever they want.
Pretty much. So if the president calls this a 12 out of 10, the underlying reality, as the journal puts it, is that the truce is, at best, marginal and, well, tenuous.
It's absolutely not a grand bargain, then.
No way.
Yeah.
The root conflicts driving the initial trade war, they remain totally unaddressed. We're talking China's massive trade surplus, their continued reliance on industrial subsidies to dominate global markets, mm-hmm. and that fierce accelerating rivalry over technology domination, specifically AI, quantum computing, advanced chip manufacturing.
Right.
The overall economic trajectory towards decoupling. That remains unchanged, even with this temporary pause.
And the momentum towards supply chain diversification, that hasn't slowed down either, has it?
Yeah.
U.S. businesses like Nicole Craft Brands, which makes arts and crafts products, they're continuing their plans to establish new suppliers outside China, places like Vietnam, Mexico, Turkey.
Right. As one VP from a large import group said, look, the tariffs are still historically high compared to alternatives like Vietnam and Thailand.
Yeah.
And customers who wanted to move production out of China, they've already done it. A 10 percentage point cut isn't suddenly going to bring them flooding back.
Yeah.
This detente, really, purely and simply, it just bought the U.S. maybe a year of reduced economic friction ahead of a major election year. It didn't solve the fundamental dispute at all.
Okay. Speaking of geopolitical maneuvers designed to maximize leverage, let's pivot now from Asia to the Americas, where we see an extremely aggressive escalation. The Venezuela threat.
Yeah, this is pretty startling.
The Trump administration has now explicitly identified military facilities, ports, and airports in Venezuela used for drug smuggling as potential targets for immediate airstrikes.
This represents a massive shift in posture, Alex. The administration is signaling that if strikes proceed, the stated goal is to send an unambiguous message to Nicolas Maduro that he must step down. They're linking the targeting of these facilities directly to his regime's illicit activities.
And the administration is explicitly framing this as a necessary move to combat the fentanyl crisis, right? Stating Maduro is sending drug and criminals to our country. White House spokeswoman Anna Kelly reinforced this, saying the president is prepared to use every element of American power to stop the flow.
This framing is, well, it's deeply political and strategic, because experts cited in the journal point out a critical piece of context. Venezuela is primarily a transit route for Colombian cocaine.
Ah.
It's not a primary producer of fentanyl. Fentanyl production is centered overwhelmingly in Mexico, using precursors sourced mainly from China.
Okay.
However, the sheer urgency of the American overdose epidemic, you mentioned the numbers, 80,000 American deaths in 2024, which is down 27% from the 2023 peak, but still huge, with synthetic opioids accounting for 48,000 and cocaine for 22,000, that provides potent political justification for maximum pressure, regardless of the specifics.
And the rhetoric certainly matches the escalation. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, for instance, he called Venezuela a narco state run by a cartel or even the Al-Qaeda of the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, strong words. And to back this extraordinary threat, the U.S. is executing a massive show of force. The Pentagon is deploying an advanced aircraft carrier and accompanying warships to the Caribbean. Mm. And they've conducted multiple bomber aircraft missions near the coast, using B-52s and B-1s. These missions are designed, you know, to probe defenses and test the Venezuelan military's willingness to react or maybe even defect.
And President Trump also took the highly unusual step of publicly confirming he authorized the CIA to conduct covert actions in the country. That effectively greenlights deniable operations aimed at destabilizing the Maduro regime.
Analysts are watching this incredibly closely. They note this is really testing that long-held assumption that Maduro is weak and that the military will flip with just a gentle push or some internal pressure.
What if they don't flip?
Well, if Maduro's military chooses to defend the regime, and remember, they possess sophisticated, often Russian-made air defenses, the risk of a regional conflict just skyrockets. The administration's allies are openly suggesting Maduro should flee, you know, to China or Russia now before the strikes actually commence.
Wow. Okay, that focus on military leverage brings us back to the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. is making a major long-term strategic investment in a key ally concerning rebalancing the Indo-Pacific with nuclear capabilities. President Trump approved South Korea building a highly coveted nuclear-powered submarine in the U.S.
This is a monumental decision, Alex. It involves a critical transfer of technology. The submarine will be constructed at Hanwha Ocean's Philadelphia shipyard. This basically grants South Korea membership in an elite club of military powers that possess nuclear-powered subs: the U.S., Russia, China, the U.K., France, and India.
Strategic significance for the U.S. must be immense. These submarines offer superior stealth, speed, long-range capacity compared to conventional diesel subs. That dramatically increases deterrence against both Beijing and Pyongyang, right? Complicating their military calculations.
Absolutely. This directly aids the U.S. goal of rebalancing naval capabilities, especially as China rapidly catches up in the diesel-powered subdomain.
But the sources stress the massive unresolved nuclear implication, the fuel supply.
That's a huge question mark, yeah. The current 2015 U.S.-South Korea agreement. It bars Seoul from enriching uranium or reprocessing spent nuclear fuel without explicit case-by-case consent from Washington.
So without that full approval, South Korea would be forced to just buy enriched fuel from the U.S. indefinitely.
Exactly. And this is where the policy decision has potential, really significant long-term non-proliferation impacts. If Washington were to grant the ability to enrich fuel, well, one professor, Lami Kim, stated that it would dramatically shorten the timeline for South Korea to produce a nuclear weapon if Seoul ever chose to go down that route, down to just months.
Wow. So this technical approval gives Seoul enormous latent nuclear potential.
Precisely. And although President Lee Jae-myung has dismissed interest in a nuclear program, you have to remember the South Korean public overwhelmingly supports acquiring nuclear weapons.
Right.
So the U.S. approval of the sub, therefore, gives Seoul a major technical head start should the political will ever change. It creates a whole new dynamic in the region.
This fear of nuclear proliferation and maneuvering seems amplified by the discussion of Russia and U.S. testing. Russian President Vladimir Putin recently hailed the first long-distance test of the nuclear-powered Burevestnik cruise missile.
Yeah, Putin claimed the missile, which NATO calls Skyfall, flew an astonishing 8,700 miles over 15 hours. If those claims hold up, it means the missile has a virtually unlimited range. theoretically could deliver a nuclear warhead to the far side of the planet, bypassing conventional defense grids.
But the expert analysis provides some crucial counter-context to the Kremlin's boast, doesn't it? Let's look at the specs. The missile is subsonic, flying only between 500 and 800 miles per hour and very low flying, between 75 and 325 feet altitude. So why do experts view this largely as a political weapon, despite its range?
Well, because its subsonic speed makes it highly vulnerable to modern air defenses. Strategists today, they're focused on far faster, less detectable hypersonic projectiles. The Berivit's complexity. It apparently requires multiple propulsion systems to engage perfectly. That actually increases its risk of operational failure. Furthermore, the nuclear reactor that powers it makes the missile highly radioactive, which, maybe counterintuitively, could make it easier to detect.
So its main function is really political messaging.
Seems like it. Telling the U.S. that Moscow can still circumvent missile defense systems, even if that ability is largely theoretical or impractical.
Trump's reaction was immediate and, well, ambiguous. He instructed the Pentagon to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis. This Trump's ambiguous vow has caused a flurry of speculation among experts, Congress, even his own military nominees. What are the three primary theories being discussed in the journal?
Okay, first, he might just be jockeying for maximum leverage ahead of the new START treaty expiration in February, using the threat of resumed U.S. testing to gain bargaining chips with Moscow and Beijing.
Makes sense.
Second, he could be responding to intelligence assessments, suggesting that Russia has likely been conducting small, very low explosive power nuclear experiments. These are known as supercritical tests, and that China might be doing similar activities. Senator Tom Cotton, for example, strongly believes Trump intends to follow suit to regain parity.
And the third possibility, the less alarming one.
The third is that he might simply be referring to stepping up flight tests of the delivery systems, you know, the missiles and long-range bombers that carry the warheads, not testing actual explosive nuclear devices. The U.S. hasn't conducted an explosive yield-producing test since 1992, adhering to the international moratorium.
Okay. Regardless of the intent, this whole episode brings the New START debate sharply back into focus, doesn't it? Especially because the U.S. faces two major nuclear adversaries, China and Russia, simultaneously for the first time in history.
Yeah, this two-front challenge is really driving the core argument that the U.S. should simply let the New START treaty expire in February. Critics argue the treaty is fundamentally lopsided. For example, the U.S. was mandated to reduce its deployed strategic launchers by 25%, while Russia made no such mandated reductions based on its starting point. Plus, Russia has stopped complying with critical on-site verification measures anyway.
So what's the strategic goal of letting it expire? What would the U.S. gain?
Well, the argument is that expiration would allow the U.S. to fully modernize its deterrent against both large adversaries without these artificial limits. This means reopening launch tubes on Ohio-class submarines that were previously sealed under treaty obligations.
Okay.
Means accelerating the deployment of the new sea-launched cruise missile, the SLCMN. That's a tactical, survivable nuclear weapon deliverable from a submarine, which fills a major strategic gap. And it means doubling the acquisition rate of the next-generation stealth bomber, the B-21.
That B-21 is crucial, isn't it? We're talking about a long-range stealth bomber capable of delivering both conventional and nuclear payloads, replacing older, less survivable aircraft.
Exactly. The consensus seems to be that extending New START would undermine the U.S.'s ability to deter both Russia, particularly regarding tactical nuclear use in theaters like Ukraine and China, which has, you know, more than tripled its arsenal in just the past 5 years.
Mm.
Geopolitics is clearly operating at a very elevated risk level right now.
It's an environment of simultaneous confrontation and cooperation, a 12 out of 10 truce achieved through painful concessions while also accelerating what looks like an unprecedented nuclear arms race.
The strange mix indeed.
Okay, from the extreme risk of nuclear confrontation, let's transition to the high-stakes financial world, which is currently obsessed with the rapid and massive build-out of artificial intelligence infrastructure. This leads us into part two, corporate giants, financial flows, and AI infrastructure.
Right. This section is all about the capital expenditure arms race and who's spending and winning in this AI transformation. We saw major earnings reports this week from the biggest tech players.
Let's start with Amazon. They reported pretty strong results, didn't they? Including 13% sales growth, that's $180 billion, and a massive net profit surge of 39%, $21.2 billion in the third quarter. The critical metric, of course, is Amazon Web Services, AWS revenue. How did that look?
AWS revenue climbed 20%. Now, 20% growth for AWS is definitely stellar on its own, but the analysis is always relative in this market. Right?
Sure.
It actually lags behind rivals like Alphabet's cloud business, which grew 40%, and Microsoft's, which grew 34%. CEO Andy Jassy was careful to clarify, though, that Amazon's growth is occurring from a significantly higher revenue base than its competitors. So that 20% growth still represents a massive dollar volume increase in the cloud market.
And the future focus is clearly on infrastructure capacity. Amazon explicitly noted that demand for its cloud and AI products is aggressively outpacing its capacity. That necessitates aggressive and probably very expensive plans to grow data centers globally.
Yeah, big spending ahead. They also had some chunky one-time charges, didn't they? Like a $2.5 billion FTC settlement over Prime policies and a $1.8 billion charge for cutting 14,000 white-collar jobs. Those expenses show the non-AI related pressures still hitting the balance sheet.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Apple delivered a pretty optimistic forecast, fueled by the highly anticipated new iPhone 17 upgrade cycle. They forecast strong revenue growth, 10% to 12% in the critical holiday quarter, which beats the 6% expectations analysts had.
Yeah, that's strong. What's fascinating, though, is how AI is forcing even Apple, which has historically been more cautious about spending compared to its rivals, to increase its investment baseline. They forecast $1.5 billion higher operating expenses than predicted, specifically due to increased AI investments. Now, while that's still just a fraction of what Microsoft or Amazon are spending, it illustrates that AI is now basically a mandatory cost of doing business, even for hardware giants like Apple.
Which brings us directly to the literal ground-up construction of the AI infrastructure boom. We saw one of the largest deals yet announced. Developer RelatedCos agreed to build a more than $7 billion data center campus outside Detroit in Saline Township.
Yeah, this is a massive undertaking. It's part of the Oracle OpenAI Stargate project, which itself is this colossal, almost unbelievable $300 billion contract designed to build new computing capacity across the U.S.
And the scale of just the Saline project is truly unprecedented in physical terms. 250 acres designed to deliver more than 1 gigawatt of computing capacity.
Yeah, and to put 1 gigawatt in perspective for you, the listener, that's roughly the electricity consumption required to power 750,000 homes simultaneously. Yeah. It's huge. Analysts suggest that the total cost of the Saline site, factoring in Oracle's contributions as well, could reach as high as $10 billion. Developers like Related are now racing not just to build the structures, but to secure the reliable, low-cost electricity necessary to feed these incredibly power-hungry AI factories.
And this rapid, aggressive build-out is rightly raising the specter of a major bubble concern, isn't it? The sources explicitly warn of an infrastructure bubble because of the staggering mismatch between the core tenant's revenue and the project's cost.
The mismatch is, frankly, breathtaking. OpenAI, the key tenant here, is projected to make $13 billion in sales this year. Okay?
Okay.
Yet, they are on the hook for an average of $60 billion in yearly payments just for the Oracle contract alone.
$60 billion per year.
Per year, average. That's a $47 billion gap that somehow must be bridged.
So what analytical assumption must investors be making to justify financing that kind of imbalance? It seems crazy.
They are making a massive, frankly speculative assumption that the utility and pricing power of AI technology will generate trillions of dollars in new revenue far sooner than it's currently visible.
Right.
The bet is that the technology will accelerate human productivity and corporate profit at an exponential rate. If that acceleration doesn't materialize, or you know, if the technology quickly becomes obsolete, that infrastructure will very quickly become a stranded, highly expensive asset.
It's a huge high-stakes bet on intangible output.
Yeah.
Okay, moving away from digital infrastructure, let's pivot to a more traditional industry that's experiencing what looks like a definitive gold rush. Pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, we're talking about pharma's gold rush. Weight loss drugs. This category is transforming the pharmaceutical industry virtually overnight, driven by a new class of molecules. Eli Lilly posted stellar sales, fueled by demand for its weight loss medicines.
And the market momentum seems extraordinary. Novo Nordisk, the other major player, made an unusual and aggressive, unsolicited, multi-billion dollar bid for a startup that Pfizer had actually planned to acquire.
Yeah, that level of aggressive acquisition really highlights how urgently companies are trying to double down on this market. And remember, this market had historically been a graveyard for drug development because of safety issues and poor efficacy.
And the financial scope is just staggering, isn't it? The weight loss category is already on track for $72 billion in global sales this year.
$72 billion.
And is estimated to nearly double, reaching $139 billion by 2030. That growth estimate forces us to consider the massive societal and insurance implications of widespread adoption.
Absolutely. And what makes these drugs fundamentally different from past attempts? The sources detail the mechanism. It involves injectable drugs like Ozempic and Zepbound, which mimic natural gut hormones called incretins, specifically GLP-1.
GLP-1.
Glucagon-like peptide 1. It naturally regulates insulin and suppresses appetite. So by mimicking this hormone, the drugs effectively reset the body's set point for weight, enabling weight loss of up to, believe it or not, a quarter of a person's body weight.
A quarter? Wow.
This level of efficacy is just unprecedented and corrects those past failures in drug development. Plus, the appeal is growing as studies show potential benefits extending beyond simple weight loss, maybe including cardiovascular health.
Okay. Moving from gold rushes to financial flows and regulatory shifts, we have significant news regarding the Federal Reserve, which seems to be reacting to political pressure.
Yes, the Fed supervision cuts. The Federal Reserve is planning to reduce the staff of its banking supervision arm by a substantial 30% by the end of 2026. This looks like a direct response to the Trump administration's promise to dial back regulatory burden and also that vocal criticism of the Fed's supposed mission creep.
And this reduction will cut the Fed's supervision and regulation division from an authorized headcount of 500 down to about 350. It's a deliberate shift announced by the Fed's new top regulatory official, Vice Chair Michelle Bowman. She apparently intends to streamline the division with fewer layers of management and, well, less interference in bank operations.
And this ties back directly to Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's criticisms, right? He has repeatedly targeted the central bank, citing institutional bloat and mission creep, claiming the Fed has played too large a role in U.S. economic policy beyond its core dual mandate of inflation and employment. The administration is actively working to reduce that regulatory footprint.
Okay. We also saw a major fraud incident rocking the increasingly complex world of private lending, the BlackRock private credit fraud.
Yeah, this sounds serious. BlackRock's private credit arm and other large institutional lenders are apparently desperately trying to recover hundreds of millions of dollars after falling victim to what they called a breathtaking fraud.
What happened?
The alleged fraud involved the owner of two little-known telecom companies, Broadband Telecom and BridgeVoice. This individual is accused of systematically fabricating accounts receivable, that's money owed by customers, which were then used as loan collateral. Private credit funds lend against these assets. So this incident really exposes a major vulnerability in this, frankly, opaque corner of the U.S. debt markets, where less public scrutiny allows for highly sophisticated collateral fraud like this.
Now let's quickly integrate some of the other corporate news that touches on these themes of global trade instability. We saw competing stories in the energy sector, didn't we? The continued strength of established Western firms versus the vulnerability of Russian assets.
Exactly. Shell, for instance, demonstrated remarkable financial health. They extended their share buyback streak after adjusted earnings rose more than expected to $5.43 billion. Mm-hmm. This was driven by improved trading performance and record production in Brazil and the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the company has bought back over one quarter of its shares in the past 4 years, that underscores a strong commitment to returning capital to shareholders, reflecting its confidence.
But on the flip side, we have Russia's energy giant, Lukoil, selling its international assets to commodity trader Gunvor.
Right. And this forced divestiture is a direct result of new U.S. sanctions imposed by the Trump administration just last week. These are the first direct U.S. measures on Russia during the second Trump administration, affecting assets across 30 countries. It just shows how quickly geopolitical pressure can translate into forced corporate restructuring.
And the auto sector continues to grapple with these volatile global trade flows, too. Hyundai Motor posted weaker earnings, specifically dented by U.S. tariffs, but they received a crucial lifeline following Seoul and Washington agreeing to terms of a new trade deal that would lower auto duties.
Yeah, the expected relief there is pretty significant. Hyundai makes about 40% of the cars it sells in the U.S. locally. They should see a 10 percentage point tariff reduction. Analysts project this could translate to maybe a 13% increase in forecasted operating profit this year, potentially rising to 22% next year.
Wow, that just underscores how devastating that 25% levy President Trump imposed back in April really was.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And simultaneously, Volkswagen provided a pretty cautious outlook, specifically cautioning on chip supply due to the ongoing semiconductor shortage.
Still.
This shortage was apparently exacerbated by the Dutch government seizing control of a Netherlands-based chip company from its Chinese owner. Beijing then retaliated by blocking chip exports from China, affecting auto production worldwide. It's a classic example of how technological weaponization instantly cascades across global manufacturing.
Okay, finally, in this section, in the world of content distribution, these massive financial flows are being fought over. We have the battle for the viewer, YouTube TV versus Disney.
Right. YouTube TV has emerged as a major player. It now boasts 10 million subscribers and is rapidly gaining major leverage in negotiations.
It's projected that YouTube TV will soon be the largest pay TV distributor in the nation, which explains the high-stakes showdown they are currently having with Disney over carriage fees. This covers critical networks like ABC, ESPN, FX. If the midnight deadline is missed tonight, subscribers could lose access to major sports and popular dramas like Grey's Anatomy. What are the key points of friction that YouTube TV is leveraging against Disney?
Primarily, YouTube TV is seeking shorter contracts, like 1 or 2 years, versus the industry standard of 3 to 5 years.
Why shorter?
Shorter contracts mean they can renegotiate more frequently, maintaining pressure and leverage. Programmers like Disney, on the other hand, who are spending astronomical amounts on content, especially live sports, they want higher fees, arguing their content is what makes YouTube TV desirable in the first place.
And there's internal conflict within the media conglomerates themselves, isn't there? YouTube TV clashes with programmers that sell their own streaming services, like NBCU's Peacock, at prices lower than what YouTube TV is asked to pay for the exact same content.
Right. As one analyst summed it up, the media industry is kind of trying to have its cake and eat it too, you know, preserving its traditional cable revenue while building competing, often cheaper, direct-to-consumer streaming services.
And YouTube TV, leveraging its massive subscriber base, is maybe the first distributor large enough to truly push back against this dual revenue model?
Seems that way. It's a major power shift.
Okay. We transition now from the high-flying world of finance and distribution wars to part three. Domestic policy, political chess, and cultural oddities. And we start with the looming absence of one of the greatest investment minds in history and how the market is reacting to that.
Yeah, we're looking at the fading Buffett premium. Warren Buffett, who's now 95, announced back in May that he is handing CEO duties over to Greg Abel at the end of this year. This transition has already started eroding a key measure of the company's value.
How so? What's the evidence?
Well, since that May announcement, Berkshire Hathaway's Class B shares have declined 11%. Now, this is a huge underperformance compared to the broader market. The S&P 500 gained 20% in the same period.
Wow, okay.
This decline signals the loss of the perceived Buffett premium, that extra value investors were willing to pay solely because of Buffett's unique genius and, frankly, trustworthiness at the helm.
And the transition means major changes to Berkshire's culture too, right? Greg Abel will take over the treasured annual shareholder letter and will lead the annual meeting in Omaha. Buffett will remain chairman, sitting with the company's other directors next year.
Yeah, and analysts at Keefe, Bruyette, and Woods even downgraded Berkshire to an underperform, explicitly citing concerns about insurance pricing, the trade war impact on the rail business, Burlington Northern, and, crucially, the absence of Buffett's leadership.
To understand this premium loss, we need to clarify the financial jargon a bit. The stock was trading at a multi-year peak, and analysts use the price-to-book ratio, or PB, to measure valuation. What does that mean for the listener, and why does it matter here?
Right, the PB ratio is really crucial here. It basically measures the value of the stock relative to the company's net tangible assets, essentially what the company owns minus what it owes.
Okay.
The day before Buffett's announcement, the PB ratio was 1.7. Crucially, the historical 10-year average PB ratio for Berkshire is about 1.3.
So the market was paying 70% more than the underlying asset value compared to an average of maybe 30% more simply because Buffett was running the show. That 1.7 ratio was essentially the peak of the Buffett premium, and the stock has been correcting back down towards its historical average since the announcement.
Exactly. But, you know, there is a strong counter narrative here that the stock was simply overvalued before the news anyway, and that the underlying businesses are fundamentally self-sustaining.
Right.
As one investment president noted, look, regardless of who is CEO, businesses like Burlington Northern will continue to produce mammoth amounts of cash flow because the machine Buffett built is fundamentally robust. The premium might fade, but the cash engine keeps running.
Okay. Now let's discuss an explosive story detailing what looks like a highly direct conflict of interest between political power and family enrichment. The crypto czar pardon controversy. This centers on Changpeng Zhao, or CZ, the former CEO of Binance.
Right. CZ was pardoned last week after serving a remarkably short 4-month sentence for anti-money laundering violations. And we have to remember the gravity of his initial plea deal from 2023. The government stated he had caused significant harm to U.S. national security by deliberately allowing sanctioned Iranian crypto exchanges, Russian drug traffickers, and even Hamas militants to move billions through Binance.
Pretty serious charges. Trump defended the pardon, stating CZ was persecuted by the Biden administration, and that he gave him clemency at the request of a lot of very good people. But the paper meticulously lays out a timeline suggesting a specific quid pro quo involving the Trump family's nascent crypto venture.
Yeah, it's all about the deal flow, as the journal puts it. Immediately after Trump won the election, Binance formed a high-level task force with the explicit goal of striking a deal with the Trump family's venture, World Liberty Financial, WLFI. The intention, apparently, was to leverage that relationship into clemency for Zhao.
And how did they leverage it?
The task force, including Binance engineers, provided the specialized blockchain technology and smart contracts for World Liberty Financial stablecoin, USD1. But the mechanism for enrichment came this spring when Binance took a crucial step involving a foreign state actor.
Okay, what was that?
They asked Emirati state investor MGX, which is run by the brother of the UAE's president, to pay its $2 billion minority stake purchase in Binance using the USD1 stablecoin.
Ah, using the Trump Family Ventures coin.
Exactly. The Emiratis agreed, and this instantly boosted World Liberty's stablecoin market capitalization from a mere $127 million to over $2.1 billion overnight.
And this action instantly generated massive revenue for the Trump family entity.
That's the claim. The entity owns 40% of World Liberty Financial and is entitled to 3/4 of the company's revenue derived from WLFI sales. This venture had already reportedly raked in about $1.4 billion in revenue over the past year, far more than the president's traditional real estate portfolio ever earned annually.
So the pardon, therefore, is cited as the most distinct instance yet of the president using the power of clemency to benefit someone central to deals that directly and immediately enriched his family's financial assets, potentially via foreign state actors.
Yeah, the scale and the clarity of the financial boost seem pretty undeniable. Despite denials from World Liberty representatives, it raises very serious questions.
Okay, moving now to domestic policy shifts, we look at the government-sponsored enterprises. The Trump administration initiated a pretty dramatic move with the Fannie Mae's ethics unit purge. About a dozen officials, including the chief ethics officer in Fannie Mae's ethics and internal investigations unit, were abruptly fired.
Yeah, this is a significant shakeup, and it's happening ahead of a possible IPO for Fannie Mae.
Mm.
The motivation was made, well, crystal clear by the FHFA director, Bill Pult, who oversees the company. He stated explicitly on social media that DEI is dead at Fannie Mae.
Wow, okay, so pretty direct.
Very direct. The sources confirmed that Pult and other leaders were specifically tired of investigations. They viewed it as being too tailored toward allegations related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. These ethics dismissals were part of a broader reduction of 62 people, signaling a powerful directive to dismantle internal guardrails related to DEI, aligning with the administration's broader regulatory rollback promises.
Okay. We also saw a significant shift in the proxy advisory space, driven by internal pressure. The major proxy advisory firms, ISS and Glass Lewis, are apparently no longer ignoring investors' deeply held religious beliefs.
That's right. For years, these firms were criticized for operating under what was perceived as a singular, often progressive, ideological framework. Now, they have agreed to work with the Catholic University of America's Bush School of Business to develop voting guidelines that will faithfully respect the Council of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
What are the implications of that for corporate governance?
Well, it could be major. For example, if a shareholder resolution urges a company to pay for employee abortions across state lines, the proxy advisors will now recommend voting no under the Catholic guidelines. This new option helps, potentially, depoliticize Catholic investing by anchoring votes on issues the church considers grave moral evils, like euthanasia or in vitro fertilization. It allows deeply held beliefs to influence corporate policy more directly.
Interesting. Let's turn now to a high-profile political chess match happening out in California concerning Schwarzenegger terminates gerrymandering.
Right. California Governor Gavin Newsom is championing Proposition 50, which has the deceptively bland title Election Rigging Response Act.
Okay.
What it would actually do is temporarily restore gerrymandering to favor Democrats. Newsom argues it's a necessary tactical counter to similar moves made in Texas that redrew districts to create 5 likely GOP House seats, apparently at President Trump's behest.
But the governor, former Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's fighting this measure fiercely, isn't he?
He is. He helped build California's anti-gerrymandering framework 2 decades ago, transferring the job of drawing legislative and congressional boundaries from partisan lawmakers to an independent commission.
And his stance is famously principled. He posted that photo in a tight black t-shirt proclaiming, F the politicians, terminate gerrymandering.
You gotta love it. When asked about the Democratic ads tying opposition to Prop 50 to supporting Trump, Schwarzenegger called them ridiculous. He's arguing that political expediency shouldn't compromise democratic principles, regardless of who benefits.
Newsom insists the gerrymandering would be temporary, ending after 2030, and it's necessary to save this republic from the threat of Republican dominance. But Schwarzenegger, despite endorsing Kamala Harris in the past, argues that fighting Trump shouldn't mean Democrats have to become Trump by adopting the very tactic they condemn.
Yeah, his position is basically that the people should win, not the politicians, regardless of party.
It's a principled stand. And that's mirrored by another shift in political optics we saw regarding the war in Ukraine. Support for military aid among Trump voters is apparently surging.
Yeah, it's doubled his rating in the last 7 months, according to the reporting. And it seems due to a strategic shift by President Volodymyr Zelensky.
How so?
Instead of ignoring conservative voters or media, Zelensky's team has made a tactical pivot toward engaging with them, giving interviews on influential shows like The Ben Shapiro Show and Newsmax. This engagement, combined with, frankly, blatant Russian actions like drone incursions into Europe, seems to have shifted sentiment radically.
And the numbers bear that out.
They seem compelling. 78% of Republicans who now express a favorable view of Zelensky also favor military aid to Ukraine. Zelensky's team apparently realized that talking directly to people who might disagree with you can create allies, especially when you pair it with demonstrating battlefield effectiveness. When presented with facts about Ukrainian victories, like taking out 35% of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, half of Republicans reportedly recognize Ukraine is winning, and 85% of those Republicans favor aid.
That's a perfect example of how communication and performance can actually drive policy shifts. Okay, and now for the delightful and frankly strange cultural pivot that somehow landed on the front page. The potato crashes Halloween.
This is genuinely one of the most bizarre cultural phenomena I've read about recently. There is a strange growing trend where children are increasingly coveting, receiving, and even trading russet potatoes as a Halloween treat.
Potatoes? Seriously?
Seriously. Sometimes, astonishingly, preferred over full-size candy bars.
No way. How did this start?
The trend apparently started as a joke by one guy, Pat Foy, who's now known as the Potato Man. He admits he's basically a prisoner of my own practical joke. He tracks long lines and gives out the biggest spuds he can source, operating under a firm rule. Potato or candy, not both.
Potato or candy.
That's the rule. And this has somehow gone viral. We have anecdotes of teenagers happily receiving the spuds as a kind of goofball Halloween badge of honor. The sources describe recipients treating them not really as food, but as crafts, keepsakes, or even science experiments.
So people are buying sacks of potatoes just for trick-or-treaters.
Why, apparently. Households from Georgia to California are now buying sacks of spuds, in some cases 150 pounds of them, just for Halloween distribution. It's wild.
It's an extraordinary example of, I don't know, post-digital age ironic novelty somehow overriding the traditional physical value of sugar. Just bizarre.
Totally bizarre.
Yeah.
Okay, moving from potatoes to much deeper social debates, let's look at the arts and opinion highlights that wrap up the day's front sections. There's a focus on the heavy ethical debate surrounding assisted suicide.
Right. The PBS film Life After, directed by disabled filmmaker Reed Davenport, offers a profoundly skeptical view of Canada's Medical Assistance in Dying, or MAID, program. The film highlights how MAID has expanded to include people whose lives are deemed unlivable, even without an incurable or immediately incapacitating illness.
Yeah, and this expansion leads to truly shocking cases cited in the review, such as a 23-year-old approved for termination because of type 1 diabetes and vision loss. The ethical question is starkly summarized by a protester sign visible in the film's footage, which reads, "Assisted suicide, the world's cheapest healthcare."
Wow. That quote is profoundly disturbing, isn't it? It forces you, the listener, to grapple with the economic dimensions of what's presented as an ethical issue. The theme implicitly asks, is the government deciding that MAID is more cost-effective than providing the round-the-clock assistance and resources required to keep people who want to live alive and comfortable?
And Davenport, who has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair, films from the perspective of the disabled community, which is often vehemently anti-MAID expansion. The documentary explicitly raises the question of who gets to decide whose life is worth living and what subjective, political, or economic determinations might factor into that decision. It transforms it from a purely medical choice into a really difficult public policy debate.
Mm-hmm. Our final highlight looks at literary theory and digital absence, reviewing Dominic Tetman's book, Ghosting. The phenomenon of ghosting, you know, failing to communicate abruptly in digital life, is explored not just as a failure of social obligation, but as a reaction to the digital age's expectation of perpetual presence.
Right. Petman links the phenomenon directly to our anxieties about death, what he calls the final disentangling of the informational self. He argues that ghosting feels so profoundly unsettling, precisely because the uncertainty about someone's digital presence is linked to this fundamental anxiety about absence, about ceasing to exist, informationally speaking.
So we're conditioned to expect perpetual contact via texts, emails, DMs, which creates this kind of interstitial world where we exist as digital avatars. And ghosting, Tetman argues, is maybe a powerful act of resistance against this expectation of being always on. It's a reclaiming of the freedom to simply vanish that previous generations kind of took for granted.
Yeah, and his most thought-provoking idea, maybe even chillingly, is the suggestion that perhaps nobody else was ever really present in the first place, that others exist only in our mental perception or our extended digital consciousness. It's a very high-level intellectual exploration of freedom and visibility in a world where verifiable physical presence seems increasingly subjugated by a volatile digital one.
It's incredible how the news cycle in, well, late 2025 can jump seamlessly from the threat of global nuclear war to the philosophical implications of being left on read. The contrast really is the story of today, isn't it?
It really is. We covered such an extreme range of topics today. The desperate scramble for AI computing power and those massive speculative $60 billion contract payments. The U.S. basically testing the willingness of the Venezuelan military to flip the high-level maneuvering around nuclear subs in Asia.
And all of this is juxtaposed against the highly volatile, almost intangible wealth created by political pardons, translating into stablecoin market cap boosts, and yeah, the delightful low-stakes cultural phenomenon of trading root vegetables on Halloween.
Which brings us right back to where we started, in a way. Value and worth. We analyzed the Buffett premium sating. That's a measure of verifiable, old-school value based on asset management and tangible company assets.
Right.
Meanwhile, we simultaneously detailed how digital avatars like CZ and digital instruments like the USD1 stablecoin are creating massive volatile wealth and direct political influence seemingly overnight.
So we have to ask the critical question that seems to weave through every section of today's reporting. In a world increasingly driven by intangible, volatile digital presence, from stablecoins to social media fame and these massive AI infrastructure bets, are we witnessing a total decoupling between verifiable physical capital and perceived informational value? Is the machine of influence now somehow divorced entirely from tangible assets?
That's definitely something for you to mull on as you navigate the rest of your week.
It is indeed. That's it for this deep dive. Thanks for joining us.
We'll catch you next time.